how can we get this to work? How can we create interdisciplinarity, sort of the symphony and this analogy to happen? So we'll open it up to our group here and just hear what people's thoughts are. And just to remind of some of the questions that we're trying to answer, it's how to transcend silos, how to get past those forces that bind our faculty so strongly, not to disrupt or remove those forces, to acknowledge the necessity for them, but to also bring together and to create synergy from the combined effort. So open it up.
I thought Susan's remarks were brilliant. I don't think you're correct about your characterization of engineering as, I forgot, essentially mechanistic. That's, huh? Sorry, louder.
Means end.
I do not believe the teaching has that quality. It's much more open. You may know exactly what happens in the classrooms at MIT and other places, but my impression is that that's a canard and a mischaracterization of what goes on. Yes, they have problem sets and they have to solve problems, but I don't believe that means ends in such a narrow sense characterizes engineering practice or engineering education. I may be wrong, but that's my own opinion.
Thanks. Back there, yeah, and then next here.
Leon Trilling, MIT. I'm an old man, and I have seen MIT go through a number of transformations which illustrate in a concrete way the various principles which you have all described, particularly Susan Silby's very apt emphasis on the importance of the four-year span for character of an engineering school. The critical time for the contemplation of the introduction of the humanities and the social sciences into a predominantly engineering school was the 1960s and 70s. There was a crisis at that time because most of MIT had been supported by the government and more specifically by the military. As a result of the unrest created by the Vietnam War and as a result of the civil rights movement which was getting underway at that time, there was a period of flux, and the traditional image of engineering as applied science, which had been supported by the military and by the example of radar and the atomic bomb and all that, was questioned in the new cultural climate or intellectual climate, and MIT began to think back of its roots, where engineers had served the public through corporations in part, through public works in part, and this implied serving the client, and therefore thinking of the needs of the client as an important part of what an engineer is responsible for. There was a institute-wide series of committees which looked at all this, and they realized that change was in order. There was also the decision that the student body ought to be diversified. At that time, it was called affirmative action. And it forced MIT to re-examine some of the ways in which it was doing things. I remember that at a meeting to celebrate Martin Luther King, the speaker pointed out that the minority population at MIT was like a canary in the mine. It warned us of things we were doing wrong and motivated us to change our ways. So the time was ripe for a consideration of a broader context for engineering. This proceeded in two ways. On the one hand, engineering faculty were urged to think of the context in which their students would work. And on the other hand, an institutional change was contemplated to give more weight to the research activity and teaching activity in the social sciences and the humanities. Many of my engineering colleagues, including Larry Bucciarelli, in fact, were very active in both of these. Let me look particularly at the institutional changes. And here there are two boundaries. One of them is we are told at MIT that it is easier to be forgiven than to get permission. On the other hand, if you are not yet on tenure, you run the risk of being qualified as a good economist for an engineer or a good engineer for an economist, and you fall between two chairs. So one might wonder, mixing my metaphors, about the sex life of silos. At any rate, under the leadership of Jerry Wiesner and Walter Rosenblith, who were president and provost at the time, and with Sloan Foundation substantial backing, MIT decided to create an entity that would promote the interaction between the sciences and engineering on the one hand and the humanities and social sciences on the other. This led at first to an effort which Larry was very much a part of, but it went out of control to some degree. And the first question that arose was, where would this new entity fit? Would it be in the School of Engineering? Would it be in the School of Humanities? Or would it be directly under the provost? The answer turned out to be that the effort split, and the technology and policy program, which emphasized policy, came under the School of Engineering, and the STS program ended up in the School of Humanities. And we have lived together, cooperated, but we have remained distinct in emphasis, and I think the technology and policy program looks more at large engineering programs in their broad social and historical context, and STS has gotten to the point where it tends to observe how scientists and engineers do their work and look at networks, look at them as objects of anthropological observation in a way. So it is an interesting partnership which continues fairly fruitfully, and it illustrates some of the issues which members of the panel have described in more general terms. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I guess, over here.
Okay. I just wanted to bring your attention to a publication David Gillette and I had in Engineering Studies, which is was a really good experience. And it had to go with the... Oh, thank you very much. Michael Hongs from... Michael Hongs from Cal Poly. It had to do with the struggles that we went through in creating the Liberal Arts and Engineering Studies program. And I think when you look at the first failed attempt and then eventually how we were able to succeed and build this program, it had a lot to do with changing the culture we had and remaking culture. And I think bringing us all together here, we have a chance to remake the culture that we collectively have. And so I don't know why status of professions is being brought up. I don't know why personal salaries are being brought up. I think what we need to do is, that was the type of thing that was brought up on our first failed attempt at creating LES. The second attempt, where we sat at the table and we listed the values that we each discipline could bring to possibly a new discipline or changing an old one, was a list that everyone could really get behind and agree, and you valued what the individuals were bringing. So I hope we can not have that first step here and move directly to the second step, where we talk about what we all can share and bring positively to an educational experience to some really passionate students. Thank you.
So anyone from the panel want to respond? Microphone.
Just one factual correction. Can't help it. But the UROP program at MIT, which is now national, was invented by a woman, Margaret McVicar.
Oh, sorry, okay. Over here.
Oh, yeah. Alice Dare, Arizona State University. I wanted to say I appreciate what you say about humanities and social sciences and its role at MIT. I was in the humanities at MIT for a couple of years as a postdoc in comparative media studies. And one thing we used to talk about a lot when I was there was the difference between comparative media at MIT and the media lab. We always got mistaken. And we would say, no, we're the ones who critique media. They're the ones who make media. And that mirrors a current divide that's going on within the humanities this very, very day, actually, at various conferences around the country. So I want to, again, emphasize that we don't monolithically look at the humanities as a content-less sort of subject, as someone brought up earlier. I think one thing that's important to recognize within the humanities that's being emphasized more and more as we experience the financial crisis is the divide between what I'm going to very reductively call the postmodernists and the modernists. My field, rhetoric and composition studies, grew out of those changes in the 60s and 70s that you were talking about. My field in particular grew out of a need to examine the way people use language outside of school so that we might better design learning experiences around writing in school. It's a very social aspect of the humanities, and within my department, I feel as though I'm the outsider because I favor things like the maker movement, things that are social, things that actually work with human beings as opposed to simply texts. But that puts me at the outside of a lot of the humanities. So I would say that for those who are saying it's difficult to find humanists who want to work with engineers, look harder at those of us who work in the post-social turn areas of the humanities, like rhetoric and composition, for example. Thanks.